across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world, on the internet, by webcast, and by podcast. My name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Unexplained. Well, we're well and truly into May, and by the time you hear this, we will probably have had our general election result here, and I'll reflect on that in a future edition of this show. Shoutouts, they'll probably be in the next edition, but we've got a truly remarkable guest here, and somebody who will fill every minute we have available. The man's name is Duncan Rhodes. You might have heard of him already. The man is the founder, driving force, dynamo behind Nexus magazine, but a whole lot of other stuff. He's based in Australia. You know that we've had Marcus Allen from Nexus magazine UK here. He's a great guest. This man is a great guest too. Duncan Rhodes is his name, and I've wanted to get him on here for a few years, so really great to be able to connect with Australia and talk with him. Thank you as ever to Adam Cornwell at Creative Hotspot in Liverpool for his hard work on the website, getting it all out to you. The website, of course, www.theunexplained.tv. That is the place to go if you'd like to get in touch with me, make a guest suggestion, tell me what you think of the show, or indeed make a donation. Now, donations seem to have slowed down a bit recently, and they are truly, I know I always say this, but they are truly important to what we do. So if you can, go to the website, theunexplained.tv, and make a donation if you can. Thank you very much indeed. Like I say, shout-outs in the next edition, probably. This is a really busy time, but I think you're going to find this guest truly, truly interesting. His name, Duncan Rhodes. Let's cross to Australia now. It's daytime here. It's nighttime there. Duncan, thank you very much for coming on The Unexplained.
Thank you, Howard.
And listen, I'm thrilled to have you on, not only because I know you by reputation and I've wanted to get you on here for a long time, but also it's always a thrill and a blast, I don't know whether you find this, to be able to have conversations like this when we are separated by 12,000 miles or thereabouts. There's you way, way north of Sydney and me here in London. It's, from what you told me before we started recording, it's raining in both places, but it's just remarkable to be connected in this way, isn't it?
The wonders of modern technology.
True enough. I mean, and that's the stuff we can explain. That's before we've even got into the stuff we can't explain. Before we talk about some of the investigations that you've been involved in and Nexus magazine generally, I want to try and get a handle on you and your interest in all of these things. Because from my experience of people like you around the world, you know, you have to have a questing mind and potentially an unusual background. So talk to me about you first.
Well, my background from my point of view is probably not that unusual, but when I start telling people about it, it certainly does remind me that everyone has a different path and a different story. Mine, I was born in England in 1961. We emigrated when I was about 4 years old to the island state at the bottom of Australia, literally the other side of the planet. Very similar weather, very similar in social headspace, as I would call it, in that in the UK and in Tasmania, to go 30 miles was something you planned for. Where I live on the mainland of Australia, where distances are much bigger, it's nothing to go 30 miles just to get the milk. But in Tasmania, it was a big deal to go 30 miles. So you stayed at home. We bought a 465-acre property in a remote part of northern Tasmania, no neighbours. We had, in the early days, no TV, no telephones. And we did it tough. When I was about 12 or 13, I decided to, upon my father's prompting, we saw an advert in a local paper advertising speed reading courses. And being a bit of a practical lad, I thought, well, I want to go to university one day and speed reading will give me a bit of an edge. And so we went to this speed reading course, and the guy doing it was a bit of a renegade Baptist minister from somewhere in America who had moved also to the wilds of northern Tasmania.
And taken up speed reading.
Yeah, well, he gave us a book to read in the introductory talk, or suggested we get a book called Psycho-Cybernetics, which is basically the power of positive thinking. And that had sort of swept America, but it hadn't hit little old Tasmania. And that really changed our outlook. We read of many examples in the book of people who had changed their experience of reality by changing their beliefs about themselves and what to expect. And it gave me it prized open a bit of a crack into the idea that reality wasn't as black and white and as as boring as I had been led to believe by a conservative school upbringing, going to Sunday school and reading the knowledge books that we had at the time.
Mm. Now, it's one thing to learn this stuff, isn't it? To be taught by somebody that this can possibly work for you. I once looked into silver mind control and actually made that work for me, which sounds like a similar kind of thing. But were you able to make that work for you? Were you able to think positively and make it happen?
It's hard to say. There was nothing I really had in mind, no particular goals at that age of my life. I was only 12 or 13. To me, I just wanted to read fast. But my father and mother certainly, around the same time the speed reading course and that book fell into their lives, they had literally just both simultaneously asked the question, what's the meaning of life? And that book came along, and then all the usual coincidences that you hear when people begin a path of exploration or discovery. It doesn't matter which belief system you necessarily end up in, when you embark upon that, it's like the universe conspires to bring the right guru, the right teacher, the right book will fall into your hands as you walk down the aisles of an old bookshop. It sometimes suggests to me that there is an element in life, maybe it is our higher selves, maybe it's an external force that leads us or gives us opportunities to take paths. We certainly took the path of self-discovery. We got into meditation, we went into vegetarianism. We were quite self-sufficient. We were killing and curing our own meats, raising our own vegetables, and quite self-sufficient. So to go vegetarian overnight based on a whole lot of reading that we'd done was quite a revolutionary act for us. But by this stage, we had we'd really started to read all the Lobsang Rampa books, I mean, everything. And I mean, it was just expanding our idea of what was being discussed. There were concepts coming into our mind we hadn't even considered or heard of before. And that was very exciting. That was very stimulating. Interestingly enough, we went further down the spiritual path and became very inspired by a community in Northern Scotland called the Findhorn Community.
Yes, I've heard of them.
Yeah, in the 70s, it was one of the few intentional spiritual communities without any particular dogma or osophy or ism finding the people. A lot of Western people were going there, and the intention was to live together in harmony, and in particular in harmony with nature. And they got quite a profile in the 70s for making roses bloom in the snow and growing 40-pound cabbages in very poor conditions. And this was achieved by one or two of their people in particular communicating with what they called the devas, or the elementals of the plant kingdom. And the conversations that were experienced by these two people were put into books. They greatly inspired my father, who sought to try and experiment with this on our own farm. And it's a bit like, you tried silver mind control, we tried quite a few other things. I guess it's more of you've got nothing to lose by trying it, really. And that's all I could see in my life is, what have you got to lose by trying some of these new things?
Truly amazing, though, if my knowledge, and it's very limited to people from Tasmania, is anything to go by. I remember the first person from Tasmania I met was a woman from a place called Penguin. You know, yes. Penguin? And she told me that she was on a grand tour of Europe because her husband had just died, but it was okay. She wasn't really sad because she didn't really like him. And she was really enjoying herself. So she struck me as being a very practical, tough, down-to-earth kind of person. And for you to be doing those things that were kind of new age in a place like Tasmania, was that difficult?
Well, it's a real dichotomy because in many ways Tasmania is to the rest of Australia what the Deep South is to the rest of America. It's where the inbreds, the rednecks and strange people who live in strange houses or do strange things live. But on the other hand, in the 70s, because of some environmental issues which arose in Australia, which were focused in Tasmania, Tasmania actually spawned the heart of Australia's very strong and robust conservation movement. It stemmed from there. Our own farm, we had turned into an organic farm, and we were one of the first organic farms in Tasmania and probably in Australia. My father wrote several books about it. We had we had some people who were regular visitors to our farm who were into organic gardening and they wanted to see it applied to agriculture. I remember a chap coming along called Bill Mollison telling my father and some other people about his new idea called permaculture. And excuse me. that's since gone around the world, and it is a very strong and vibrant movement of hundreds of thousands or millions of people to this day. So Tasmania, paradoxically, was backward in one sense, but very forthright in producing a lot of activists in a lot of areas. We actually successfully applied some of these communicating with nature ideas on our farm. We had a deal with the snake kingdom, wherein we said we would stop killing snakes if they stopped coming near the house and killing our cattle, and that worked.
Oh, you had a deal with the snake kingdom?
Well, we thought, what have we got to lose? And we stopped killing the snakes, and they stopped coming around the house, and we never lost another cow to snake bite. We had a deal with the wallabies, which are like a small kangaroo. And, I mean, in the 70s, a typical farmer, your attitude is anything which eats grass, you should shoot it because it's less food for your cows. Anything which can kill you, you should shoot it because you're doing mankind a favour. So we had quite by this stage revolutionised our own thinking about nature, and we decided to, you know, take the approach that nature as a whole and as individual species were sovereign life forms, which were, you know, should be accorded due respect. After all, you know, we're one life form amongst many. And the idea that we're taught in Western culture that life is survival of the fittest, and sometimes that the fit have the right to survive, can lead to a real, I think, an unhealthy relationship with nature. And the more we're discovering in our scientific quest to understand our bodies and how we work, the more we're realizing that it's impossible to beat what nature has designed and created out there. Now, that might not apply to the human body. There's a lot of argument which suggests evolution is a flawed theory to explain the structure of the human body. In particular, the human body, it doesn't have a lot of musculature, the pain experienced during birth, etc. These are things which the human body experiences, which suggests that it could have been an interruption in the natural evolution of things. Because when we look around at the other species, they've all got the perfect package in terms of everything that's required of them, but the humans don't. Anyway, that's a bit of a tangent we can explore elsewhere in the conversation.
Yeah, but it seems to me that all of this taught you the art of the possible, and to reject the notion that a lot of things are barred to us because they're simply not practical. You learned in all of that experience, by the sounds of this, that if you can see it, if you can conceive it, you can achieve it.
Well, towards the end of the time on the farm, and we sold the farm because we wanted to set up a spiritual community in Australia somewhere. So we sold the farm. But before we sold the farm, the communicating with nature was starting to work on a bit more practical level for us. I mean, when we wanted to move herds of cattle from one field to another, and by this stage we'd gone organic, we'd stopped putting the superphosphate on the soil, and we were harrowing in the cow paddies back into the soil and rotating cows from paddock to paddock. Our grass did not look as healthy as the ones next door, but the cattle and the sheep next door used to bust their guts trying to get at our grass and eat it as opposed to their own, which became a problem. But in terms of a practical use of communicating to nature, we thought, well, we've got to move 200 head of cattle from 50 acres to 20 acres, and it's a half a day running around to round them up. How about we telepathically ask them to all be gathered at the corner of the paddock where the gate is and save us a heck of a lot of running around? And that was really starting to work before we moved off the farm. So there were neighbouring farmers. The guy who introduced us to speed reading, he had an apple orchard on his property, and he lost a lot of his apples to the cockatoos. And so he was continually shooting, baiting and trying to net them. And he heard about our deal. And I've got to say that he didn't like doing this. He didn't get any, I mean, nobody got a particular glee out of killing the animals. It's just something you felt you had to do because you had no choice. And here we are experimenting with choices, with the outcome, well, what have you really got to lose? You end up where you are to start with. So he said to the cockatoos, look, you have those scrubby trees down the bottom corner of the paddock, which is hard to get to with a tractor and equipment, and leave the rest of them, and I'll stop shooting and netting and trying to poison you guys. And that pretty much worked. He said you could go down there and the cockatoos were usually congregated in that corner. There were a couple of neighbouring trees, but he was astonished, and he sought out to make it work too. There were a lot of people. My father talked about it on radio, and a lot of other people tried it. I didn't hear of anybody making it work with ants or cockroaches, but certainly with furry animals and feathered animals, there was a good success rate.
Well, I think you've just explained something to me, Duncan, that I wondered about for a very long time. About 10, 15 years ago, I went on a holiday to Portugal, and there was a sea life centre there. Now, this is maybe a trivial example, but what you've just said explains an awful lot to me. I arrived and was not going to be back there another time, so it was a one-off visit. After the dolphin show had been on, now, you know, I'm not saying that a dolphin show for the public is necessarily a good thing to keep these things in captivity, not fair, but it was there, I went to see it, I wasn't as enlightened as I am today. The show had ended, but they were still around the tank. So I thought of them, and people thought that I was nuts when I told the story afterwards, but I thought of them, at them, please can you let me see what you do in the show, because I'm never going to see it. And they put on a show for me. So in that instant, I was sort of persuaded of the things you've just talked about. You can have that kind of interaction with nature.
Well, it's even bigger, I think, than you suspect. In the last few years, there's been quite a number of humans who've developed fully functioning two-way telepathic, you know, communication with animals. And this is past fuzzy feelings. This is very specific direct communication where a lot of information of incredible detail is imparted to the human. It came to my attention in Australia of such a person, and I've got to shamefacedly admit that before I spoke to this person, my view of animal communicators were sort of new agey people who got feelings about dogs and cuddly animals and were, you know, maybe largely correct, but I couldn't see the specifics of it. Coming through. I was referred to an animal communicator to speak at our conference, and I was absolutely blown away by the very detailed experiences and conversations that she had.
Is this Trish McCarkey you're talking about?
Yes, Trish McCarkey was the one we had at our conference. And I employed her as a result of being very impressed with her presentation. I employed her to communicate with my own dog, which had developed cancer. And I wanted to ask the dog, her to ask the dog whether the dog wanted to be put down or whether the dog wanted to stay alive, you know, via the use of drugs or possibly surgery, although by this stage drugs was the only option, and maybe we'd get 2 or 3 years, but at the expense of deterioration of the dog's kidney and livers, because the drugs might extend, you know, the lifespan, but the body does deteriorate, and there is the risk of undetected pain in the animal as well. So I asked her to ask my dog whether, you know, what it wanted to do. I mean, you know, this is taking recognition of sovereign life forms to the point where, even though I've been technically custodian and owner of the dog, I wanted to recognise that the dog had a sovereign spirit or a sovereign free will and destiny, if you want. And the information which came back absolutely blew us away. Trisha had I wouldn't call her a family friend who had any understanding of our family structure, context, history or background or anything. But the dog told her everything from its point of view, which was incredibly non-judgmental. And this was the common thing I noticed with all the animal communicators. None of the animals seem capable of judging humans in a negative light. Certainly get confused or don't understand, but they just don't have the ability to judge like we humans do.
And Duncan, when you're talking about a communication, sorry to interrupt, when you're talking about communication with a dog, is it on a feelings basis, or is the dog actually having rational thoughts and putting them together almost as sentences, like we speak?
The way Trisha hears them, and she comes from a scientific background, a dental technician by trade. She was at the vets with her cat, and she heard a voice in her head, and she turned around looking for the source of the person. And after a while, she realised it was the cat, and that was the beginning of it. She can hear them that clearly, very clear sentences in her head, as clearly as if someone's in the room. And she doesn't have to be in the presence of the animal. All she needs to know is the animal's name, and a photograph is usually required, and then she can set up instant communication with it wherever she is. And I believe she asks permission of the each animal to, you know, to begin the communication. Again, the recognition of the fact that, you know, that they're a sentient being might not want to be disturbed sometimes. And I think it's the most exciting area of research on the planet at the moment, to be honest. And, I mean, I say that spanning all the fringe science researchers, including anti-gravity and over-unity energy, all the ancient mysteries around the planet about our history and ancient past, and with the paranormal UFO stuff. I think that the future for mankind to make the grade really is going to stem from mankind looking around at the millions of life forms that surround us. We call it nature, etc. But you've got to step back and say, well, heck, regardless of size and shape, these are all sovereign life forms. And it's when you start communicating with them that you start to get that perspective. Now, I just want to briefly go back to Trish McCarr's communicating with my dog, because the dog basically said to her, look, my time here on Earth in this lifetime has finished. I've done what I came here to do, which was to be in this family unit, to assist with the children to go from this age to this age. If you want me to hang around, I will, but it's totally up to you. We asked it in another conversation where it wanted to be buried and how it wanted to be put down. And again, it said it doesn't matter. All that is all your growth, your experience. It doesn't matter to me. Incidentally, months after we had the dog put down, I asked Trish if she was able to reach out and communicate it with again. And she was quite surprised at the request because it hadn't occurred to her. And so she did, and to everyone's surprise or not, she was able to communicate with my dead dog, who was equally surprised and felt quite flattered that a human would, you know, deign to reach out and communicate with her. And she described her environment as being non-physical, and she was working with a bunch of probably what we would call young dog spirits, who she was training into what to expect on planet Earth when they take on a physical form as a dog. And, I mean, a whole lot of detail about her whole life and experiences and how happy and proud she was to be assisting in the, you know, helping young souls to evolve up the chain. It's quite incredible. I could talk for hours. There's another lady in South Africa, Anna Breitentak, I believe. And I was amazed to find that her communication skills with animals are equally as clear. I mean, there's one shot on a video where she goes out in the wild and literally walks up to a pack of wild baboons, communicates to the leader, lays on the ground, and the baboon comes over and grooms her head. I mean, these are animals which easily kill a human.
Mm. And, I have a lot of sympathy for this stuff because I can remember being just a couple of years ago in a wildlife park one of the better ones, not like a zoo style, but a proper wildlife park in South Africa, probably 5 years ago, with a group of people who were trying to communicate with a big white lion there called Letsatsi. You might have even have heard of Letsatsi because he's famous throughout South Africa. He's a big guy. And everybody was asked their thoughts. And I was asked my thoughts, about what he was thinking. And I thought, I'm not sure about this. This is a bit wacko even for me. And I said something about he's not getting, there was something in his diet that he wasn't getting. And I said, he's telling me that he's not getting enough of whatever this was. And they told the keepers there, and the keepers said, yeah, that's right, we've been giving him more of this. So it is bizarre, isn't it? But, you know, potentially a real game changer for us.
Well, I think more than you realize, the animals consistently tell the humans who are talking to them that they hear all the humans' thoughts all the time. If anything, they learn to screen them out because it becomes a background noise. But they hear everything we think in a non-judgmental context. And the other thing, every human has the ability to do this level of communication. There is no magic switch in the brain. It's something which seems to be awakening in more and more people. And these animal communicators are spending pretty much all their spare time helping and training other people into opening this door. Now, this segues nicely into another area of research, which I've mentioned on a couple of other radio shows in the last few weeks. That's the work of Clive Baxter, an American chap who is widely accredited for the discovery, invention, and application of the lie detector machine. He went on to do a lot of work proving that plants have measurable responses on meters and machines in response to stimuli and conversation, if you want, but more the intent. So there was a famous book came out in the 70s, The Secret Life of Plants by Tompkins and Bird, and a lot of Cleve Baxter's early research, I believe, is mentioned in that book. But Cleve, he died only, I think, a year or maybe two ago, but his research towards the end was being circulated amongst researchers like myself and others on the internet. I would have liked to seen it written up, but I can tell you what he was working on, because, and this is in the civilian area. I've also had people tell me that this was militarized decades before. But what Cleve was working on before he died was very exciting, and it takes the whole idea of communicating with other life forms to a new level. He, in his last series of experiments that I was aware of, he took a he was in his big warehouse laboratory research field with a bunch of people, and they had a lady assisting them with the research. They sat on a chair and they took a swab inside her cheek, basically getting a whole lot of human cells on this on the cotton wool swab, and they transferred this to a petri dish with a type of culture in there to keep the cells alive. And the petri dish was wired up with his particular sensors and electrodes to a visual and audio meter. And very similar to the equipment he had for plants. When you walk up to a plant with an angry impulse, visualizing you're going to rip its leaves off, if you do it with the impression of anger, the plant really responds. But if you can have the same thought in your head but with loving intents, and the plant won't. But anyway, the bottom line is he's got this fancy equipment which gives a video and audio signal when stimuli is applied. So the human cells are in the petri dish. They then take the woman that was the donor of these cells into another room, and as she's walking in, another assistant makes her jump. And she didn't know this, of course. So she literally jumped out of her skin, and instantly the cells in the petri dish responded and gave off an audio and video alert, even though she's not physically connected to the cells. Now, this phenomenon was repeated different ways. So basically, regardless of distance, those cells gave a stimuli readout of whatever happened to her was reflected in the cells, regardless of distance. It raises many areas of exciting avenues of research. Particularly, one is what is the communication medium that links the cells in the petri dish to her 5 miles away? How are they communicating? Are there signals being pushed through the atmosphere, or is there a type of underlying substrate, electrum, or ether? From which matter is formed, which the communication is going through, or is it done on a psychic ESP level, which we have yet to define? The bottom line is, when you discover that life forms down at a cellular level and down at a bacteria level have the ability to sense and respond, you start to think, where does life end, and where does the sovereignty of a life form end? And you know, who are we to judge, regardless of size, shape, or cell structure, what intelligence is? If something has consciousness, surely we should be respectful of that. And I think that is the direction mankind would go. And when you think about it, if we are not alone in the universe and there are other life forms out there, I think they would be a lot more comfortable embracing us into their societies if they saw us treating the life forms on this planet with dignity and respect, you know, regardless of whether they were a cute panda or a, you know, an ugly weed. You know, each is a sovereign life form. And you know, it leads us down the direction of one day more and more people being able to communicate with more and more life forms. It opens the door one day that you can communicate to your food, regardless of whether you're vegetarian or vegan. You could technically communicate to the cells in your cancer tumour. The cells and the bacteria, I mean, the billions and trillions of bacteria in your gut, on your skin, in your eyelashes. I mean, there's another statistic if you want to consider sovereign life forms. The human body is only actually 10% human. 10% of the number of cells that comprise a human body are human cells. The other 90% by number are the bacteria and microorganisms that live all through your ear, nose, throat, your gut, and skin and hair. Granted, the human cells make up the vast majority of size and weight, But by number, we're only 10% human. We're technically a biome. We're a multiple organism. And really, the human body is dependent upon these billions of other microorganisms to sustain our health and life.
Exactly. So we think of ourselves, Duncan, at the top of the tree, don't we? We think of ourselves as being pretty superior. In fact, if we're only that percentage human and we're a huge percentage everything else, which we may share in common with other life forms, it sort of puts things into perspective a bit, doesn't it?
Well, I think it's time for mankind to still respect, you know, who we are and what we are capable of. But I think in context with getting along with the other life forms, I think it's in our interests to do that. I mean, if we can communicate with other life forms, I mean, why does it matter what size, shape, or even physical density they are? Once you've opened that door, a crack, one life form, you know, it's the principle at stake. So if you can communicate to other life forms, whether they're here or not here on this planet, on this radio frequency of reality, I think it would serve us a lot better in terms of, just on a practical level, our human health. I mean, if you can communicate with what's going on in your body and get to the source of it, I mean, surely that could be an advantage.
You talked about potentially communicating with your food, which was a point I didn't want to lose. I'm just imagining the situation, and I know that you're brought up in a farming background, so you might have a take on this that is quite unique. But imagine the situation of confronting, you know, say, for example, beef cattle, and, you know, communicating with them about the fact that you might be having them for dinner. I wonder if they know that that is your place in the world. In other words, you are here in the way the things are configured at the moment to consume them. Do they know and accept that?
Well, I don't presume to speak on behalf of beef cattle, but the communications I have read from other food source creatures and even prey of other wildlife, there seems to be this total non-fearful acceptance that just as they have to consume other organisms for their current organism to survive, so they are consumed by other organisms as well. It's like, I mean, this is going a little bit of a field, but some of the perspectives of life on Earth that are given to humans by what we would call ETs or extraterrestrials or visitors often comprise the idea that Earth is a bit of a unique planet in the sense that let's put it this way. I've heard and read Earth described as a designated conflict planet, and which is quite a shocking thing to say, but when you think about it, every life form on this planet pretty much can only exist by consuming other life forms. Now, it appears that if you are communicating with life forms, that seems to be an accepted part of the order of scheme, right down to the point where, well, we wouldn't be here if we didn't know that was the deal. So when you hear animals and plants suggesting that and alien visitors suggesting that, you sort of think, well, maybe we're the last ones to work this out. Now, we have in the West a belief system introduced, and dare I say it, which has now become almost a religion on its own, because to question it is heresy and we have to take it on faith. But I refer to the theory of evolution, which I adhere to on a conceptual basis in the sense that all life evolves from one state to a more self-aware state via experiences. I don't particularly have much time for the theory of evolution as taught to us in schools. And I say that more because I consider myself very versed and researched into the details of what's implied. Like I can, like if I'm in, with a scientist who knows the science, I can debate the theory of evolution right down to asking them, How is explained that the first life forms, which had no nucleus, the first cells on the planet had no nucleus, and all of a sudden, like overnight, we had cells with nucleuses and multicellular life forms evolving? There's been no mechanism to explain that transition, is what I'm saying. And when you actually examine the theory of evolution at a scientific level, it is so full of holes that it relies on ignorance of people to be self-sustained, to be honest, and this includes a lot of scientists. There is this trust that someone else has done the research and filled the gaps, but when you speak to the scientists in those fields, they will more and more admit that there are gaps, and that those gaps could be doorways to other other suggestions or other explanations.
But it's a difficult road for some people to go down, isn't it? Because if you assume that we, we didn't evolve, then you have to assume that we were somehow put here. And if we were somehow put here, somebody did the putting.
Well, this is the shame of society. It's like you have to choose the scientific viewpoint. And a scientific viewpoint, when you wrap it up in the one package, it's saying a very bleak message. The scientific viewpoint encapsulated is basically saying that everything you see around you, all the magic mystery of life, the creatures, the stars, everything you see around you created itself out of nothing for no reason. That's what the scientific, rationalistic, mechanistic viewpoint bores down to. There's no meaning to life. It's the feelings you have are chemical experiences giving the illusion of a feeling. It was an accidental big bang which just happened to explode at the right velocity, if you want, to allow matter to form. By a stroke of some luck, inanimate matter became animate, and that matter suddenly wanted to reproduce. It wanted to have food. And you know, it's a type of life form only created which can exist from consuming other living organisms. Actually, I should correct myself. The only organism on this planet that doesn't consume other organisms are the plants. And it's like the ideal life form you would have thought on this planet, which had it evolved naturally, would be a plant, because the plant sustains its existence from solar radiation and from nutrients from the soil. It's it is a different road to go down, and I'm comforted by the fact that nearly every culture on the planet, and including the Western culture, we look at our own Bible, they have this one common factor, is that beings from the stars came down and mated with us, taught us engineering, animal husbandry, astronomy, irrigation, mathematics, agriculture, and brought with them this incredible desire to suddenly build huge monuments for hundreds of years, cutting rocks and moving them into geometric positions, which are in specific geometric relationships across the planet. To suggest that jump was... I think coming from within mankind, I think too much to believe.
Well, we seem to be getting closer to some kind of discovery. I spoke very recently to Klaus Donner, who I'm sure you've spoken to as well, the Austrian guy, and he, of course, has been researching giants recently, and the fact that 20-odd thousand years ago there may have been a race of 7.6 metre tall, I call them people, but beings on this planet, and we're finding remnants of them, supposedly. How do you explain that?
Well, look, the stories of giants are legendary, and what I find intriguing are the continual reports I get from people of cover-ups and suppression of our ancient history. I have to conclude that there is a widespread and long-standing prosecution where anything anomalous archaeological is removed from mainstream academia to study and carry on with. I've met a lot of people during my years of doing Nexus. I've travelled around the world, gone to lots of conferences, organised lots of conferences. And before the internet, before that medium where you could suddenly communicate, reach out and find more information, I would get a lot of people come up to me or contact me personally with pretty much their experience, their story, their disease cure, their ET experience, their scientific discovery. And some of the most interesting ones were people working underground in mining situations or... For large mining companies, there are a lot more discoveries made out there in the last 100 years, but of such a controversial nature that the mine doesn't want to come to a screeching halt. So in some cases, things were destroyed. In other cases, government people were there so quick, shutting the place down for 2 or 3 days, making everyone sign secrecy agreements, and the mine was allowed to carry on. So, you hear this over and over, and then you go to these countries like South and Central America, and you hear the same pattern down there, where corruption's a little bit easier to organise at a local level rather than a bureaucratic level. So I would like to say that, these discoveries, while tantalizing, have already been made, and behind the scenes there is a great awareness that mankind once was very technological, and if anything, we've probably following what Michael Cremo postulates, human devolution. And, even if you look at what the Romans achieved 2,000 years ago, those guys had hot and cold running water, sanitation. They had a really good lifestyle. Look at London only 200 or 300 years ago. The streets were open sewers. After the fall of the Roman Empire and the rise of the Holy, the Catholic Church, the Vatican, don't forget, for centuries, the Church confiscated anomalous archaeological findings from all the countries that it expanded out to, through whether it was Portugal doing the expansion or Spain or other countries. They took skeletons, they took manuscripts, they also wiped out from most of Europe the psychics, under the guise of prosecuting witchcraft. Anyone who was psychic or knew herbal medicines or could do astral projection, maybe read palms, these people were hounded out. And, of course, the scientists were persecuted, and they were doing the work of the devil. I mean, the people who, when we had our Industrial Revolution and we start off in the history books and we hear about how we developed these spinning jennies and we suddenly were able to make, cloth, before electricity, right? It was like a big breakthrough. We could make cloth again. And when you understand the context of what was happening, the Church was stopping anyone making any machinery. The two Americans who made the first weaving machine, if you like, they had to do it late at night with curtains across their windows, lest neighbours thought that, they were building, God help them, a machine, and then the machine is the work of the devil. So the Church actively stifled and suppressed technological development, scientific understanding, until only a couple of hundred years ago.
So Duncan, do you think that there are people now, and I'm taking you off at a bit of a tangent here, who may be sitting on remarkable technology that we don't know about, and they have this, but they're afraid to release it because of opposition from vested interests? I'm thinking about things like time travel.
Well, that could be a hairy one, but I have spoken to people who were in military units which were involved in either guarding or removing anomalous archaeological artifacts and sites. I also know that several times when the West has gone to create a sensitive new military base, that often they discovered an existing infrastructure underground at the same location. In Australia, we have a very famous base called Pine Gap. Mm. It's like a sister to your own Menwith Hill. And I've spoken to several people who are now dead who were involved in various aspects at the beginning of the construction of Pine Gap. And it came from two or three different sources that when they started work at Pine Gap, they found an existing ancient complex going deep into the ground for like another half a mile. And so one could only presume that there was maybe technology or other infrastructure that they could use. Now, what this reveals is another line of research, which I picked up when I was a late teenager. I got into everything I discussed with you, but one of the turning points, one of the first turning points of my life after I was into meditation and spiritual awareness and yoga and health foods and learning astrology and all these wonderful ideas, I came across a book by a New Zealand airline pilot called Captain Bruce Cathy, who had done a lot of work into UFOs. While he was an airline pilot, he and other pilots and passengers regularly saw UFOs in the 1950s and 60s. And when he talked about it to his superiors, they always told him to keep his mouth shut, that the right people knew about UFOs, and if you kept your mouth shut, you'd keep your job. So he basically set out to do his own research. He was quite annoyed. He thought this was one of the biggest things facing mankind. The recognition that we're not alone in the technology that could come from it, from his mind, was ridiculous to suppress it. So he did his own research, and to cut a long journey short, he noted that the unexplained UFO sightings across New Zealand formed, if you look at them on a map and put pins on the map, they formed a type of equidistant grid system. Now, he went on to do a lot of research of this hypothetical grid and found that the grid was evenly spaced at proportions of the Earth's surface at that point, particularly minutes of arc, which are a proportional measurement. So a minute of arc in the northern hemisphere could be a slightly different distance than a minute of arc in the southern hemisphere because of the pear-shaped nature of the shape of the Earth. That 1 minute of arc would actually give you a bit of a wider space out the surface of the planet, which would translate into more miles. So all of his mathematical understanding of this postulated energy grid was based on ratios of distance. Now, sure, he found that this grid went through and intersected many of the ancient mystery sites on the planet, but he noted it also went through and intersected at many of the modern high-tech installations, such as Menwith Hill and Pine Gap. And he went on to do a lot of research on the side. He suggested that atomic bombs cannot explode just anywhere at any time. He suggested a new model for explaining the cause of the explosion. Now, in our books at school, we're taught that when two enriched subcritical masses are pushed together, like thrown together at each other, the chance of one of the little particles hitting another particle and setting off the chain reaction goes from unlikely to a certainty. Okay, this is in layman's language. That's what we're taught in schools. He said that's rubbish. He said if that was true, the bombs could always go off and stockpile because of, you know, there's no subcritical masses small enough to stop that, the chance of it happening by their own understanding. Instead, he suggested that just like this energy grid scales around the planet, he proposed you can scale it down to an atomic or molecular level or up into a solar system or galactic level. The same holds true. So he suggested that the atomic nucleus is actually destroyed by achieving a state of resonance, very similar to how an opera singer can shatter a wine glass. And to achieve this resonant state, the sun and the Earth have to be in particular positions relative to each other, which is pretty much what we call the time of the day or night. And the geographical location of the explosion needs to be precisely determined to achieve this overall state of resonance. Mind you, there are still a lot of these windows. Now, he was invited early on in his research to join we would call them a black science research group, if you like, scientists and people who obviously had this technology and knowledge, which included Russians, Americans, Chinese, Indians. The condition was if he joined these people that he would not be able to talk about any of his research. He would have unlimited funding for his disabled son who needed 24 medical care and supervision. And he and his wife turned down joining them with its attendant financial security, because they both believed the information that they were working on was far more important for people to know and chase up. Unfortunately for most conspiracy theory researchers, especially in America, most people don't have the attention span to understand Bruce Cathy's mathematics. There's been a bit of an uptake of it in the UK, where there's been a lot more awareness of what you would call ley lines, the geometry of standing stones, and the relationship of different sacred sites across the UK and Europe is recognised by many of your researchers, and you know, and some of them, to their credit, have extended those energy lines across Eastern Europe, Russia, and right across the Indian subcontinent into Southeast Asia, where we find the lines intersect more temples, more sacred sites, more standing stones, where we call them jars, in Laos and Cambodia. And all through Southeast Asia, we've got, again, ancient man has denoted where this grid runs across the planet with geometrically positioned and designed standing stone artifacts.
And we have good reason to know about that here. I am talking to you from, 85 kilometres, not even that, 80 kilometres from Stonehenge.
Well, there you go. There's no doubt that an ancient technology established a lot of the positioning of key, what we became religious sites, with a particular scientific and practical function. Now, the nature of civilizations as we've gone on has been, you saw it, when the Romans went out and conquered somebody, they didn't kill everybody who didn't adapt, although in some areas the Christians certainly did. But what I'm talking about is when you were a occupying culture, it was in your interests to to observe the same dates of the year, but maybe put your festivals on those dates. And so what we call Christianity is very observable if you do the research, that a lot of the dates that we've staked out in Christianity, i.e. Easter, were dates that the early church poached from previous civilizations. But more importantly, and to the point here, is that each successive civilizational victor, if you like, they also put their sacred buildings on the sacred sites of the previous civilization, a bit like a dog, you know, marking its scent higher up the pole. So in other words, the sacred sites have come down to us through the centuries. So a lot of modern sacred sites are actually also on this grid, is what I'm trying to get to. And it's no accident. Behind the scenes, though, it's very evident. Behind the scenes, though, it's evident that this technology has been reawakened and reactivated and certainly used for quite a few decades. Who's using it, how and why? You know, this is where conspiracy theories step in.
Well, exactly, and that takes us back to, for example, Pine Gap that you were talking about, and the fact that there was something else on that site before. So there is knowledge that transcends the era and the species, not the species, but the race of people around at that time.
Well, a lot of exotic information sources, as you might call it, in my particular case, which would include people with security clearances, interviews with humans that have had extensive communication with what we'd call aliens, and in many of these cases are not on the record or in the public domain. There's certainly a lot of exotic sources of information which suggest that Earth has been home to many civilizations of mankind in various shapes and forms for a lot longer than we suspect. So I think that's an accurate picture, to be honest, looking at the situation. The shame of it is that the way modern archaeology dates an ancient city, especially in South America, where you've got these amazing standing stones of precision cut, positioned and placed, and you can see clearly that an earthquake has displaced them eons ago. Well, the archaeologists of the day, all they do is they go around the stones and they dig down until they find some either bones or campfires and say, well, these people made these stones and put them here. End of story. And, you know, to me, that's a rather primitive and limiting conclusion, because if I was wandering around after some post-apocalyptic situation, which all the records seem to describe, and I came across the ruins of a city, I'd start using that as the wall of my hut, I can tell you. And so my fireplace would be at the bottom of it. And if I had cattle, I'd be putting barriers between the stones and using them as a corral.
So we need to start thinking more sequentially then. We need to start thinking about our place in the scheme of things rather than us being dominant.
And the problem is that you do hear these continual stories, people like Virginia Steen McIntyre, who, an ordinary archaeologist working on a controversial dig, well, wasn't controversial until after the findings were discussed. She and her other colleagues were told or asked or told or even threatened to falsify their scientific data to change the date of what they were looking at. This was another, I think it was South Central America. This was a dating which showed that mankind was there way before the out of Africa theory says that it was physically possible. So anything which disputes the out of Africa theory, I mean, there have been anomalous findings here in Australia of cave paintings, and the furor that erupts is absolutely incredible. I mean, there may be vested egos and peerships and internships, you know, at risk out there in academic lands, but, you know, the data is there. But we find that archaeological science trumps geology. It trumps a lot of other branches of science. It was either Michael Cremo or Lloyd Pye addressed an Exos conference in Amsterdam 10 or 15 years ago, and they had scientists in the UK, geologists in the UK, had discovered a way of dating cut stone. And the first ones they wanted to test it on, of course, were Stonehenge. Now, up until then, all the testings had given infallible accuracy rates. There was no problem with this dating thing. But the dates that they gave for cutting of Stonehenge were tens of thousands of years before the accepted date. Well, way more than 10,000 years before the accepted date. And so rather than adjust archaeological theory to geological fact, no, that geological fact and its technology were shunted aside, basically ridiculed. They'll never see the light of day again in any accepted sense, and archaeological theory trumps. That is how strong and how much vested interest. I would say that only happens because the powers that be do not yet want mankind's true history revealed to it. It would disrupt science, it would disrupt religion, and in many ways it's probably as big a pill to swallow as the idea that there possibly are aliens out there that come and visit us.
So do you feel like a voice in the wilderness, Duncan?
Well, I'm aware that there are thousands of other voices in the wilderness, but I'm aware that they're all quirky, kooky people like me who think outside of the box. I mean, we live and function in this so-called normal society, but I'm finding more and more that society is starting to move back towards conservative science. The rise of the science shows in the mainstream media, like Mythbusters.
Mythbusters, one of my favourites.
I love them too. Big Bang Theory. I mean, culturally, yeah. on all the TV networks and all the TV stations, the last 10, 15 years, especially the last 10, has seen the rise of the nerd. The worship of science has been put higher and higher. More and more people pride themselves on having a scientific stance and sneer and snigger at people who believe in homeopathy or people who even think that UFOs, you know, might be real.
So where does that leave us?
It leaves us with a growing, rift between people who have a view of reality which is a lot richer and a lot more questions. I think it's a lot more exciting. I think it has more choices available to you. Or you have the conservative view of reality, which is more and more the state saying, trust us, trust our experts, trust our medical system and our medical experts.
Which ties into something that we can talk about another time, but this whole thing about control, the fact that we are getting more and more consolidated in every area of our lives, government particularly, maybe global government we're moving towards, there is more control over people now, and yet we think of ourselves as free.
Well, some people out there very happy to give over their control to the state and to the experts and take that weight off their shoulders. They're very happy to do that. But for those who don't, it's being made increasingly difficult. Across America, the dream of being self-sufficient on the land, more and more states are putting up impediments to allow that. More and more people are finding their crops are contaminated from farms 100 miles away. In the battle line is really being brought up, drawn up more about your sovereignty over your health, and particularly your children's health. You as a parent, are you allowed to make the decision about whether you should deny your daughter when she's got cancer? Should you deny chemotherapy in place of an alternative approach? And as a parent, how informed are you to make that decision? I mean, there are a lot of issues to debate there about it, but at the end of the day, who is in charge of our children? The state, through the medical system, through various other branches, the whole child sex and protection areas. It's like the state is really moving more and more to say we know best for what your children should be taught.
And yet certainly, when I was a kid, I think we needed and we welcomed some intervention by the state, helping parents get through, you know, helping people through problems of poverty and advice on nutrition and all of that stuff. I think in my generation, we didn't really know enough, and some of that was useful. But you can take that good thing too far.
Well, you know what changed was the advent of the internet, the release of information, where anybody now with a question can become relatively self-informed on a wide variety of things. Not a lot of people, though, have the confidence to do it on health issues, but more and more people are looking around at, I mean, you know, the Google is being used more and more by people to explore what other people are doing as a healthy option to, you know, non-serious medical conditions, whether it's a skin issue or whatever.
Well, I think you're right. So, I mean, a trivial example, I broke my shoulder a couple of years ago and was in quite a lot of pain for quite a long time. And I was helped by a thing called Bowen therapy, which I'm guessing you may have heard of. It was devised for use on horses, and it's very non-intrusive. In fact, there's very little touch involved, and the Bowen therapist touches you in a couple of key places, then walks out of the room as if you were an animal that needed to calm itself down, and then comes back and does a little more, and then you go, and somehow you feel better. I certainly did, but God knows how that worked.
Well, look, I think rather than have these therapies poo-pooed, we should be looking at how and why they're working. And obviously, this rocks one of the biggest vested financial industries on the planet, which is the medical pharmaceutical racket, if you like. But some of this area of research, it again speculates down what is the medium at work here. What is it about energy fields that these people are doing? And you know at the back of your mind, if something like this can work on a baby or an animal, you know that's not the placebo effect. Mm. And the placebo effect, I got to say, is phenomenally effective. It should be studied on its own so that more people can look at using their own mind to physically change their metabolism and their body. Now, we did an article a few years ago on the extent of the placebo effect, and it was quite an amazing information journey, particularly because I read of a study where they did surgical, I guess you'd call it the surgical placebo effect. They took a group of people who required a surgical procedure in order to fix their problem. Again, it was minor. They only did the actual surgical procedure on some of them. The rest of them, they made the incision and then sewed it up without doing anything further. They all recovered as if they had had the surgical procedure.
Gee.
And this has been shown elsewhere. Skeptics like to say, well, you know, it's a placebo effect that works, but skeptics should take a leaf of their own book and take that further, because you could argue that a heck of a lot of pharmaceutical drugs could be the placebo effect in some cases too. It's a fascinating thing.
We have a lot to learn.
Also, I want to refer also to a remarkable scientist you have living in your country who I hope has been on your show and will make my next 5 minutes a lot easier, Dr. Harry Oldfield.
I have to say, to my shame, I've never heard of him.
In the UK, one of the most amazing mad scientists I've ever met, and we've brought him over to Australia a number of times. Harry Oldfield is, he wouldn't say he keeps to himself. He's not a self-promoter. He has developed some of the most extraordinary technology I've seen, and it's available commercially. It's used largely for health and healing, more in the form of diagnosis. What he has developed 10 or more years ago, is a way of filming and photographing the human energy fields. Now, I've got to stress, this is nothing like the aura pictures you see where you stimulate a high voltage experience, or the new age trade shows you've been to where you have a Polaroid photograph and you have this wonderful rainbow aura around you, which is slightly different for everybody and can be interpreted any way you want to pay for. Harry's technology shows you real-time your body's energy fields on a healthy person with no clothes on, and the clothes have to be taken off because clothes hold enough energy to mask the what I'm describing. So a naked, healthy man shown on Harry just points the video camera at the guy on the screen real-time. You see this person's acupuncture meridians and you see the chakra spots. It's validation, if you like, of two completely different cultural health belief systems, the Vedic chakra system and the Chinese acupuncture system. You can actually see it. But it shows many other things as well. This technology has been used to look at ghosts. And when the ghost comes through on the screen and the rare times that it does, you not only see the ghost, but you see the furniture in the background of the period that the ghost imagines itself to be in.
Really?
On the screen. It's extraordinary. Cloaked UFOs. You can't begin to imagine some of the things he's turned this to. Two very fascinating implications and areas that he works on this. Number one, you detect the illness that a person has, the illness is detected outside on the extreme edges of the human energy field. So if you were developing a serious illness, months or even weeks before it's physically manifest, it's detectable in your energy fields and you can see it, and if you like, you can start to work on it to dissipate it. If it comes all the way in and gets close to the physical body, it becomes a physical condition. And that in itself I find extraordinary, but it's there, repeatable, observable, testable. It's there.
Well, listen, you radiate, Duncan, a huge amount of energy yourself, and I presume that you are using some of this knowledge upon yourself because you are a dynamo.
No, I just get excited by it all, and I get excited by it. I get excited by telling people who haven't heard of Harry Oldfield and some of these other things before. But this next bit will probably open up a range of radio interviews you could do after you have Harry on there to explain some of this. One of the things of his technology that fascinated me the most was he was showing me a picture of a human, and inside their energy field, very close to the body, it looked like a huge slug or leech was wrapped around the person just above the waist, big at one end, narrow at the other. It looked like a huge non-physical leech had attached itself to the person. And I wanted to know what it was. And Harry said that there are quite a few humans on the planet that have one or more of these attached to them. He said if you were to remove that thing off that human, which can be done quite easily using technology, he said you would see white light pouring out of the human energy field like a torch through a bit of dark cloud. So what we find is that there are a lot of humans out there. The common denominator that I understood that all these humans have with these leeches stuck to them, these non-physical energy parasites, if you like, stuck to their bodies on the energy level, all of these humans had one thing in common that I could detect. They all had unresolved emotional traumas. Many were sex abuse victims, incest when they were young. Others had, a couple of cases I believe were sudden car accidents. Again, a major trauma which some people don't resolve. These people, the unresolved trauma seems to be that they have what we would call a hole in the aura, where your energy is just pouring out into space. It doesn't kill you to have it happening, but it's probably like a wounded human walking through the rainforest. Sooner or later, a leech is going to be attracted to the blood and come along and help itself.
And you said these things can be removed by technology. It sounds to me like the kind of thing that exorcism could remove, but technology?
I worked out pretty quick that he was talking about people who hear voices in their head, urge them to do self-harm and to do crazy things. A lot of these people with these attachments are into self-loathing, self-hatred. They're not happy people, and they often take it out on others, so they can be quite angry or violent. A lot of them turn to drugs. So it's, I think it should be seen as a health issue in a lot of these cases. But So obviously I said to him, I said, good God, Harry. So I said, you mean most of the people in the psychiatric institutes, I said, they're likely to have one or more of these attached to them. Why don't you just go into the middle of each city, turn on your machine and put out the frequency which repels all of these things and get rid of them from all these humans? You would cure all half the people in a psychiatric institute.
Good idea.
He just laughed. He laughed his head off, and what he told me next, it changed a lot of my outlook on life and came back to sovereignty and free will. He told me the first time he encountered a person with one of these on there, and he showed it to the human, and he said to the human, do you want me to get rid of it? And the human said, sure. So he laid him down on the table. Harry started broadcasting the frequency, and next thing you know, the human got up and punched Harry right in the face. And then abruptly apologized profusely and said, look, he said, I don't know what came over me. Basically, they worked out that this non-physical energy parasite did a bit of a self-protection mechanism and was not going to leave and was prepared to temporarily override its host to stop it from being removed. To cut a long discussion short, it seems to be that these only are removed when the human starts to acknowledge or address whatever issue or unresolved trauma is in their history or their background, some form of self-forgiveness, removal of self-blame. I mean, a lot of sexually abused girls at the age of, you know, below 10, they grow up secretly blaming themselves all their life. And these sort of things have to be almost dug up, exposed to the light of day, re-examined and put in a constructive context inside a human psyche rather than in a destructive context. So they can be removed, but I guess the paradox is after more investigation, you realize there's a symbiotic relationship between these non-energy life forms, these non-physical energy parasite life forms and the human host.
So if you take these things away, you've got to be very careful what you put back in their place.
Look, I sort of think, again, here is validation of the fact that we are surrounded by life forms. We look out of the window in our garden physically and we see trees, birds and insects interacting with each other. The flowers, do they know that the bees are pollinating them? Do the bees know that they're accidentally helping the life cycle of plants by virtue of their own existence? There's so much symbiosis between life forms that we're only beginning to discover. It's like one huge dance rather than one huge fight for survival.
That's a lovely way of putting it. Duncan, we're out of time. I just want to talk to you very briefly, and I want to come back to you, if you wouldn't mind coming back on this show. I'd love to get you back on, but you're working at the moment on something that is connected to all of the things that you talked about, and that is more freedom of information, and you're a bit of a conduit for that. Can you explain what you're doing at the moment?
Well, I decided many years ago that to find out what's really going on, it really is a good idea to position yourself at a point where people come to you and tell you. So getting into alternative media before the internet was a really smart idea. People sent me books for review and I got to meet lots of people who came to me with stories and information. When the internet came along and more people have used the internet for alternative information sources, my primary vehicle has been Nexus Magazine for the last 25 years. It's headquarters in Australia. We send it out to people like Marcus and other countries and other languages. But that comes out in print every 2 months. And obviously there's more and more information coming out. So what to do about how to get the overflow and how to get more of this information out to more people in a coherent form. So about a year or two ago, I started to work on a dream I had. It's called the Alternative News Project. I created a non-profit company entirely separate from Nexus. And basically at the moment, we are reproducing all the alternative news that you would find on the internet each day. We put it in one huge news feed and we break it down into different categories and subcategories, which allows a user to absolutely personalize what they're interested in. We can output that news and information to a particular postcode or to a whole country or a particular language. But we're covering all the non-mainstream news. It's like you've got mainstream news. I mean, anyone who travels from Europe to Australia to America, you pretty much see the same news with a slight local variation or context, but it's the same thing. You can put pretty much mainstream into one basket and say, this is mainstream, it's predictable, you know what you're going to get when you go to a hotel in another country. But then you've got all the rest. And currently for people, you spend your own time and risk and you search a lot of places on the internet. You might find a few places which give you a good aggregation of alternative health or inspirational or just conspiracies. But there's no one out there putting all the non-mainstream categories into the one basket except for us at the Alternative News Project. We've received massive support and endorsement from many of the writers and researchers, groups and organisations out there. They are submitting material to go onto the feed to be seen by more people in more countries, and we in turn are driving traffic back to those sites and to those writers and researchers. So it's a way of strengthening the alternative internet, if you like, the alternative writers and researchers out there, whether they're in health, science, ancient mysteries, paranormal, or, you know, human rights issues, environmental issues, living on the land, consciousness, spirituality, all those things are going on the feed, and the next phase is we'll be putting more local information. So right now, if you're interested in fracking, you'll see all the international news about fracking that you would normally see. But if you lived in Wisconsin, you would see all the fracking news about what's going on in the state of Wisconsin, which is more down to local meetings, local protests, etc. Stuff which the Brits don't want to see on their news feed, but there was people in Wisconsin do.
Well, so I think this is fascinating. You know that I was trained and I work still in mainstream media, but I have a foot in this camp as well, which is extremely interesting and a labour of love to me. I'm fascinated by what you're doing. But Duncan, we're out of time for this time. Would you like to come back on?
Absolutely.
I'd love to talk to you again. I mean, look, I get guests on here sometimes and I have to, I mean, look, I've been trained in broadcasting and journalism, so I'm never short of a question. I can always come up with a question, but there are some people I have to lead along the way. I certainly don't have to do that with you. You are a dynamo and a pleasure to interview. So please come back on. If we can do this in a month or two, that would be fantastic. Duncan, thank you.
Thanks, Aaron.
Oh, and one quick thing before you do go. If people want to know about you and the Alternative News Project, it's only fair to let you tell people where they can see that.
www.alternativenewsproject.org.
And from early afternoon in the UK, lunchtime, to late night in Australia, I say thank you very much, and I send you my warmest regards, Duncan. Thank you.
And the same to you, Howard. Thank you.
We are out of time. Truly remarkable man who I promise we'll have on again. What did you think of him? Email me, let me know at www.theunexplained.tv. That is the place to send me feedback about the show, guest suggestions, your thoughts about what I've been doing here, how I can do it better. And if you'd like to make a donation, you can do it there too. Thank you to Adam Cornwell, my webmaster at Creative Hotspot in Liverpool, for his hard work as ever. And thank you to you for being part of The Unexplained. Until we meet again here, please stay safe, stay calm, and stay in touch. My name is Howard Hughes. I am in London. This has been The Unexplained. Thank you and goodbye.